Dr. John Littell, welcome to Politics and Science. I really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you.
You came to my attention when somebody forwarded me an article where you did an analysis of the PCR testing. And I'd like to talk about that primarily today. But I'd also, before we start, maybe you could just give us a synopsis of your training and your background and where you are and what you do.
Yes. Hey, John. Thank you for having me. I'm a family physician for quite a few years now. Originally studied up at Cornell and a little bit of postgraduate work in physical chemistry at Columbia, and then went on to George Washington for med school, and then the military for 7 years and taught residents in family medicine. But for the last 22 years, anyway, I've been down here in Central Florida, initially in group and now in solo family medicine. But I've always been politically active. I shouldn't say always, but at least the last 10 years for sure, very involved in the politics of medicine because of the many challenges facing independent family doctors or doctors who are independent in any specialty. So I made a point out of getting up to Washington, D.C. with various congressmen and senators over time and kind of pleading the case for independent practice of medicine because of my concerns that other forces in society are dictating how we doctors deliver care to patients. And I'm sure you're familiar with a lot of that. So
I may be, but if you'd elucidate some of that, I'm not so sure that I am aware of it.
Yeah, no, it's getting worse by the day. So you start with the American Hospital Association, which is probably between that and the American Pharmaceutical Association, the two biggest lobbies. When you think about healthcare in this country, you'd like to think that, for example, people think of the American Medical Association. Well, only about 25% of patients, really physicians, are members of the AMA. It hasn't been a very powerful influence as far as lobbying goes, but the American Hospital Association, oh my gosh, they are really at the forefront of not just orchestrating Obamacare when that came out, but now buying up practices of doctors left and right and realizing that doctors are a revenue stream for their profits. So the model of hospital care has increasingly gone towards who can make us the most money, and then they have many arrangements worked out where they can obviously reimburse people coming out of training. My daughter, who's a residency, I mean, more and more the young doctors coming out are going to work for hospitals because the hospitals, we physicians can hardly compete economically with the hospitals. So when they own the docs, they own the referrals. You know, a primary care doc comes into a hospital employment. Now everything that doctor orders is going to be done through that hospital system,
right,
which generates on average, So that's just the hospitals alone. Then you get the pharmaceutical industry, which last I checked, about 70% of the articles that are written in medical journals are written by people who are on the payroll of one or another pharmaceutical company. So it's very hard to get anything, really independent thinking-wise about what to prescribe for patients. You put that together with the government agencies, NIH, CDC, FDA. We just got a lot of challenges in medicine. There's so many people that tell us how to do our jobs. Oh, did I forget the insurance companies? Cigna, Aetna, Humana, United, all are telling us every day what we are doing wrong or bonusing us or penalizing us depending on how much we comply with their directives. And the quality measures for healthcare. The people who are determining what is quality healthcare in this country are not doctors and patients. They're administrative types up in D.C. There's a whole panel. So I can go on about how far healthcare has become removed from the patient-physician encounter, in the doctor's office. I mean, we rarely see that anymore. It's more people following protocols that are dictated by these other agencies.
Yeah, it sounds like a consolidation of power and a lessening of actual healthcare.
Oh, yeah, healthcare isn't what it used to be. And you know what else is going to consolidate that power even more so, which is I see friends of mine flocking towards this. I've been doing a YouTube series just to kind of get to ventilate basically for people who want to go to Dr. Littell on YouTube, but the last one I did was on the depersonalization of healthcare. The editor actually put a typo in there, so forgive for that. But But bottom line is I now see people wanting to do this telemedicine routinely. And now insurance companies, right now, for the last 9 months, doctors have been getting paid exactly the same fees for doing telemedicine as for seeing a patient in the office, 100%. That's under some emergency measures that were passed. Well, there may have been some justification for that if a patient was home with COVID and, well, oh, you really need to see these people and listen to their lungs and heart, you know, but which I've done all along. But I someone who's homebound, but, you know, you've got people going grocery shopping and going to wherever, Christmas shopping, but are still only doing telemedicine visits with their doctors, you know. And the insurance companies are paying 100%. Well, you know, we can, anyone listening to this can figure out all the problems with a doctor just doing his visit with the patient over a computer screen or a telephone for that matter. But that's where it's heading. And I believe it's going to be something that's going to become a permanent part. From what I'm listening to doctors, they really love it. The docs love it. Unfortunately, too many docs love it. And, I think that they're all kind of lining up to figure out how we can become, you know, how things can get more convenient for us as doctors, which that's not what being a doctor is all about. It's not about personal convenience, obviously. It's meant to be more certainly of a vocation for that. And the patient-physician relationship needs to be one-on-one, a face-to-face encounter. Without that, I don't believe you have any true healing, as I've said many, many times.
Yeah, it's like the digitization of our lives is happening right now. We're, you know, school is going remote. Many fields are going that way because of this whole quote-unquote crisis.
Yes, you're right. My whole family, I have five kids, and my wife, and interestingly enough, almost throughout our whole family, we're either in healthcare or education. I'm waiting for I need a good mechanic in our family, or you know, even a lawyer wouldn't be a bad idea. But no, everyone flocks to those fields. But yeah. No, forget the lawyer. but no, it is true. We're all suffering. We're all saying the same thing. We miss the interpersonal contact. I don't. I mean, my doors have been open, you know, 24/7. I mean, I've been on call this whole nine, ten months. However long it's been, well, actually for the last 20 years, but during this time especially, I mean, just this morning, I got already two phone calls from people who were worried about COVID, and I get the calls at all hours, and I have to explain to them, you know, here's the symptoms, and here's what you need to do, here's what you can do to prevent it, here's what you can do to treat it in the early stages, here's whether you should or should not go get tested, and that's the articles I wrote, which we can get to. You know, there's so many questions. And what's really happening in society right now is people aren't getting options. They're just being, they call the health department and, you know, they flock to the health departments wherever they get tested. They're told that they're positive. They're treated like lepers. They're told to quarantine 90% of the time. They don't need to. And then they're never offered early treatment. So we wait for them to get to the hospital. We have doctor's offices. I know personally doctors who won't see people who are sick with COVID. They go to the emergency room, go to the health department. I mean, since when have doctors so completely abandoned sick patients? I mean, I know pediatricians. One of my patients took her daughter, who had had some chronic issues, just for a regular school physical, to her pediatrician. The pediatrician looked at the mom and said, "Why did you bring her to the office today?" She said, "She's here for her school physical." She said, "You take her back home. She has no business. She shouldn't be out. She should be in her home." The poor girl, 10-year-old girl, right, being told by the pediatrician that she shouldn't even be out in public because of there's COVID in the atmosphere. You know, and this is, I'm not exaggerating this point. I mean, there are many, many people who used to be good doctors who are no longer good doctors because they're practicing based on this model of fear mongering, that rather than offering hope and treatment to people.
Do you think they're victims of the same basically hyperbolic you know, fear-mongering that's going on every single channel of the news, the mainstream news?
You got it. You hit the nail on the head. Physicians are human beings too, aren't they? Just like ministers and priests. And we've always been held in high esteem as the people who we watch the television shows and the movies, and it's always the doctor who can who'll go into the midst of the epidemic and be the hero. And now we're finding more and more that doctors are really suffering from humanity. I mean, so many doctors I see are just scared. They're running scared. I see them in the hospital. I see it in their faces. They won't come close to me in a doctor's lounge. They don't, you know, of course, no one shakes hands and everyone wears the mask, which we can get into whether that even does any good. But try to engage in a personal conversation. I actually got in trouble in my hospital, one of my hospitals that I go to, because I was having a conversation without a mask in a doctor's lounge. And the other doctors complained. They said, you know, he shouldn't be talking to us without a mask on. I'm like, well, guys, you know, we this is not helping us to wear these masks. I take care of people who work in the hospital. Those little flimsy surgical masks don't do anything. And they know it because they're the ones who take, you know, a lot of them, and their friends are taking care of patients with active COVID. And you're still getting exposed, and you're going to get sick if you don't do the right things to prevent it and to treat it in the early stages. And that's what I told all of them. I mean, it's a matter of exposure, not wearing the doggone surgical mask. So we can get into that. But really, you're right. They're as fearful as the parents of school children who won't send their kids to school, or the people who refuse to go back to church or, you know, synagogue, or, you know, the people who refuse to go out to eat at a restaurant. And thank God I live here in Florida, where we have many more freedoms than a lot of places do around the country. I understand you're up in Vermont. I don't know how it is up there, but
it's getting worse.
Yeah, well, yeah. It is getting worse. And honestly, to be honest with you, and for anyone, I'm not sure how people listening to this, what the time frame will be, but as of today, December, whatever this is, the 18th or 19th, yes, I'm seeing more cases of COVID, but I'm also treating. I mean, I had a guy today call me 80 years old. I had another, a 43-year-old minister. Those are the two calls I got this morning. Actually, I got a call there, but I will get that after we're done here in a little bit. So there are more cases, but I've told everybody I know, all my patients, I say take, when I say cases, we need to get into what I define as a case. I have an article I wrote, but there are more people testing positive, okay. But there are also more people who are legitimately ill, who are losing their sense of taste and smell and have cough. Oh, but here's the problem. I'm on the phone with them, or I'll see them in the office, and I'll say, you know what? You really just have a cold. You know, you have a common cold. And yeah, you may test positive for COVID, but you're not showing any of the signs of COVID pneumonia or other severe consequences of C19, COVID-19. So I tend to say to patients, listen, right now, if you just have a common cold like symptom, just don't get tested, because, you know, and this is what I'll tell them on the phone. Should I go get tested? I said, well, right now you have a head cold, right? Yeah. What else do you have? I have a low grade fever, you know, and I'll ask how old are you, and ask what other underlying conditions you have, and to kind of get a sense of how bad would this person be affected if it truly was COVID-19. And if it's not someone who I believe is going to be severely affected, and, you know, we all know the statistics on people below the age of 40 or even 50.
No, we
for
don't.
That matter,
actually,
even under 70.
If you would say that, that would be great.
Yeah, no, I mean, the reality is this disease is virtually non-existent in children. All right, first of all, let's get up to high school age anyway. The death rates from influenza are 10 times that what they are from COVID-19. I mean, in an average year. So, and we do not overreact and panic because 250 children unfortunately die from influenza every year in this country on average. So we don't go into a frenzy or a panic, and we kind of accept that there's always a small number of children and some of those with underlying conditions. And when we talk about children in pediatrics, they say under the age of 18. So we're not talking about typically 2 or 3 year olds and 6 and 8 and 10 year olds in elementary school. So that's number one, the children. The college and high school kids, such as two of my own, that got COVID. I honestly didn't care at all that they got it. They had a little head cold, loss of smell, loss of taste, and no other symptoms. You know, no morbidity or certainly no mortality. So the mortality rate for people under the age of 40 is less than 0.5%. I mean, it's virtually non-existent. And then, of course, over 75 is where it gets up to closer to 5%. And again, with my two patients who died from COVID, I'm just going to share with everybody, I have two practices in Florida, thousands of patients. I've got a nurse practitioner and helped me in one of them. That's how I'm able to do that. But We've had only two deaths in the last 10 months, okay? I've signed over 20 death certificates from other deaths from other causes, you know, normal things, metastatic cancers, heart disease, but only two patients that have died from COVID. One was a 77-year-old gentleman who did have metastatic cancer but got COVID while in the hospital, I might add, developed a severe pneumonia, ended up on a ventilator, and because of his other underlying conditions, he never came around, and he was taken off of life support after several weeks on the ventilator. The second one, again, tragically acquired the COVID while rehabilitating in a nursing home, assisted living facility, to be precise. And he was 96 years old, but actually quite active. He was just recovering from some other conditions, and it was one of those nursing homes where it just ran like wildfire. And again, in the nursing homes, they were not offering any early treatment, anything, you know, not even the multivitamin therapies, but certainly not hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin. And the daughter called me and said, "Dr. Littell, can you take care of him?" I said, "I can't while he's in that particular facility because I don't have privileges." And I'm not sure if the readers know this, but or listeners, the majority of nursing homes in the country established a policy that did not allow doctors to even come in there and see patients without having to be tested themselves for COVID. And so a lot of the doctors stopped going because they didn't want to run the risk of getting a false positive test and having to stop practicing medicine. So a smaller group of docs started going to the nursing homes. Of those who went, probably 0% even offered early treatment because it just wasn't something that's been done. And so the early treatment I'm talking about is the hydroxychloroquine in the early stages. You need to start within a couple of days of the onset of symptoms. And then now we're really looking at this ivermectin. So there's two options that are viable options. They weren't offered. This 96-year-old gentleman, of course, ultimately came to the hospital where I could take care of him, but it was too little, too late, and you know, he didn't have the reserve in his lungs. So I'm only throwing those two cases out there to show the listeners or demonstrate that the overwhelming majority of the 300,000 dead from COVID-19 have been people, and I don't have the exact number for you, over the age of 80, and again, the overwhelming majority of them, multiple other underlying comorbidities that just made it harder for them to fight the fight, which is the case with both of my patients. And then you have, on top of that, when I did my video, the YouTube on why case numbers going up is not bad news, it's because the CDC told us back in March that anything that has a positive COVID test is going to be called the cause of death is going to be COVID. I mean, if you have a positive test, they could come in for, have had a stroke, have a heart disease, have metastatic cancer, but if they test positive for COVID when they come into the hospital, the cause of death will be COVID. And where the politics and certainly the economics come into play is the fact that the hospitals, and I used to know the exact number, but I don't have it at my fingertips, are reimbursed at a higher rate for a COVID death than another death in the hospital. I'm sure and that's not being made up. I actually brought that up in the doctor's lounge with the chief financial officer, the CEO of the hospital, and the chief medical officer, and the two of the three didn't know about that. I said, you know, you guys make more money off of COVID deaths. And he said, no, we haven't heard this. This is probably back in May. And sitting over at another table by himself was the chief financial officer, and he stuck his head up and they asked him, what do you know about that? He said, yeah, we do make extra money. They do pay us more. And the thought process at that time was to offset the losses of the hospital because they had to suspend routine, you know, elective surgeries. And to some extent that makes sense, but it also adds, I saw the doctor scurrying. I literally had a patient who had open heart surgery back in May, and they're running around trying to get a rapid test on this guy while he's on a ventilator to see if he's COVID when it was nothing related to COVID, you know, and the reasoning for that was to see if they could get that positive COVID before he died because he was in the process he wasn't going to make it. So, you know, so in other words, had he died and had he had the positive test, he would have been a COVID death even though he was not a COVID death. And so that's a very important thing to understand. For in general, that these deaths, I know people who've lost loved ones to COVID legitimately, but I have patients who come to me at least once a week and say my aunt, even their own parents died in another state or in this, and the death certificate said COVID, and they know darn well it wasn't COVID. I mean, I'm hearing that a lot.
That's so, just about to happen to me and my brothers and sisters, because our mother just died at 101, and she had been tested quite a few times over the past few weeks, and she was negative once, and then positive, and then negative. It was like the test didn't seem to mean anything, but the I haven't seen what the death certificate says yet, but I'm afraid that's what.
If you get one positive, that's all it takes. And the reason for the false positive test, that was my last video. I did one called who to believe and what to trust, or what who to trust and what to believe. I forget, just after Thanksgiving, and I mentioned how the antigen. Okay, this is really important. And when I made this video, I didn't understand this concept of a cyclic threshold. But it's real important that anyone listening, and since this is on science, cyclic threshold is simply put how many times they have to spin.
Can you start at the beginning, Dr. Littell? Because the PCR test, maybe just describe what it is and how it works.
Oh, yeah, thank you for making that. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Well, I am not a scientist, but the polymerase chain reaction is basically a way of trying to detect in the laboratory, okay, the presence of a protein, of a protein. You see, every allergy, so when people have allergies or you get infections in your body, that's some sort of a protein that comes in from outside. There's a virus, that's a viral protein or bacterial proteins, and your body's job is to eliminate it by producing two types of immune response, either the antibodies, which is called your humoral immunity, also beta cells, but antibodies, immunoglobulins, proteins that we then in turn would try to, in your bloodstream, attack these things. Of course, it starts when it comes into your respiratory tract. Let's say in this case, you're breathing it in through your nose, and it comes into your mouth, and then the mucous membranes is where these things take place, these reactions, this fight is taking place. So that's why you get increased amounts of mucus when you have a cold, because the mucus is actually where the war is taking place between this foreign protein and your body's antibodies, which is the proteins that we produce to fight the foreign proteins. Okay, so what the testing that's being done in the lab is looking for is when they shove a swab in the nose or the throat, the mouth, and they stick it in and they process it in the lab, they're looking for the presence of the foreign proteins, these particles, also known as antigens. Antibodies attack antigens, and so that's where those two terms come from. So the antigenic material, the protein material that's coming into our bodies, is being measured in the laboratory. All right. So you start measuring that, and then they're looking to see what the quantity is. Well, with these rapid tests, we're not actually giving a quantitative analysis. We're just doing what's called a qualitative. It's either positive or it's negative. You're not being given what's called a titer. Another example would be for people who have autoimmune diseases, we do what's called an ANA, anti-nucleic acid antibody titer, antigen titer, I'm sorry. And it'll come to us as a titer. Very low would be, when 1 to 2 would be low, 1 to 640 would be high, meaning it had to go through so many times. Well, what we're finding out with this antigen testing is that the labs are having to cycle it through many, many times. Every lab is doing it, and until they get a positive test, all right? Now, so what ended up happening is they did a study, and I have it not in front of me, but I've seen this study in Science Magazine, I believe, is where it was published, or might have even been the New England Journal, where they showed that if they do the swab and it only takes 10 cycles for it to be positive, then 80% of the time that person's going to grow out the virus in the culture. I mean, that's a pretty good reliable result. If it's showing up right away, which is makes sense, almost like someone who's doing a home pregnancy test and it comes out positive in 1 second, right? The woman knows she's pregnant. Others, you have to wait, or a rapid strep test. So what I'm saying with the cyclic threshold is the labs have been cycling these through 20, 30, 40, 50 times to get a positive test. And all it's doing is picking up little bits of the antigen, but it's not growing out in the culture. These people are neither sick nor contagious. So our governor in the state of Florida recently, 2 weeks ago, said to the labs, you need to cut back on your cyclic threshold to anything less than 30 or even, I believe, either that or 25, and don't report the other ones. Now, to my knowledge, that hasn't happened anywhere in the country, and I'm not even sure it's been implemented here in Florida, but what you're getting then by shoving swabs in people's noses and sending them to the lab and them cycling it through is you're picking up people who've just got enough of the protein of the COVID-19 antigen in their respiratory tract to be a positive test, but not enough to be sick or contagious. And so that's why we're all being thrown for a loop.
I see. So the illness, whether you actually have symptoms and are ill, is determined by the volume of the virus that you have inside you.
Totally. Yeah, the viral load. So absolutely. That's why the people who are here getting sick. The people who are intubating the patients, the nurses who are with them for 12-hour shifts, the person that you live with, a kid who's, a kid comes home from college, and you're around this kid, for days in your home, then you get a higher viral load, and yes, you have a higher likelihood of getting sick.
So if your immune system is very weak, a lower load might tip you over the balance and you'll get sick. But if you have a normally functioning immune system, you're probably resistant to it unless you're really overwhelmed by a large volume of virus. Is that correct?
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. And the immune systems is where we've missed the boat on this issue. We've really missed the boat on helping people, to build up their immune system. That's where the vitamin D, the zinc, comes into play. Obviously all the other things people should know, how to stay healthy in terms of not being obese and getting plenty of exercise. A healthy immune system is vital, and that's why I don't worry and my kids don't worry, about this thing.
And so going back to the test, the PCR test, which everybody is doing, I think it's being used all the way around the world for determining whether people actually have COVID, and it seems to be what's driving the case numbers. If you cycle that test, it's basically amplifying the amount of virus you have from your swab sample. Every time you cycle it, it doubles it, or I think it goes up logarithmically, I'm not sure. But I've seen a video of Fauci talking about this, and he was saying if you go over 30, it's going to come back with a lot of false positives.
I believe that's been discussed before, yes, and yet we aren't observing that. We're allowing the labs to still produce these false positive results, and some got into trouble for it, and I don't know all the details in front of me. I can tell you another thing that came out, and this was reported in, I believe, Science Magazine, where they looked at kids with the common cold and how many of them, when they did the antibody test, had antibodies to SARS-CoV-2, COVID-19, even though they just had the common cold coronavirus, the simple coronavirus, and they had no exposure. So there's a cross-reactivity phenomenon that's also occurring that I've been arguing that no one's able to pick up, because we have never in the history of medicine tested people with a common cold before, ever. We've never shoved swabs in the noses of kids with colds. So like my son's school, I get notes from the principal, oh, another child tested positive, we're so sorry, and they start, I'm like, first of all, you shouldn't be testing children, period, end of story, the same way children shouldn't be wearing masks. They just aren't an at-risk population. And if we're going to do this, we should, if you're going to put masks on kids this year for COVID, then keep them on masks forever for anything, because they don't do squat and they're not necessary. But if you're testing them and they have a common cold, the simple little coughing congestion and head cold, you don't need to test them. And if you do, you run the chance of getting false positive tests because of the cross-reactivity. No one's, done this before. So we're the same thing with the flu patients who have the flu-like illnesses. You probably have heard that there's no influenza going around. I've seen dialogue with pharmacists all over the country. No one's writing for Tamiflu because everything's COVID. But that's what everything's being called. Someone calls in with a body ache and a fever and a cough. It's, according to the CDC, that's sufficient to call it COVID. Interestingly enough, even without the positive test in the right setting. So everything's COVID until proven otherwise right now, and it's just not right.
Yeah.
It's not true.
And then those test results, which you're saying have numerous reasons to have false positives because they're the criteria is being so liberally applied, that means that the, our policy, our public health policy, is being set according to these tests that aren't actually legitimate.
Right. Yeah, our public health policy is, this is where you look at the politics a bit, because you say, why? Then people say, why would they do this? You know, why are we unnecessarily testing? There was a weekend, I'm sure you know this, about 2 months ago, where Anthony Fauci was in the hospital with something unrelated, I know yet. And somebody from CDC actually put out a statement from the CDC saying, do not get tested unless you have the following symptoms and you've been around somebody who has COVID. You know, you're symptomatic and you have a history of exposure to COVID, don't get tested. And instead, we've got people flocking to get tested with minimal symptoms and no exposure history. And when Fauci came back, he took that down from the CDC, said, don't put that out. He wanted the maximum number of people to get tested, which is, what they call a surveillance testing. This one, know what's out there. Well, you're not going to get a reliable outcome or a reliable assessment of what's out there if you get this huge 90% false positive rate, which is what they found in Massachusetts and New York and elsewhere. 90% of the people were false positive. So how is that driving our policy? I believe what it did, obviously what it's doing is it's just heightening the fear. I mean, it's creating a lot more phone calls for me, that's for dang sure. And, someone tests positive and I get the call, and should I go back to work? Should I stay home? I say, okay, forget that you tested positive. What are your symptoms? You know, where have you been? Where do you work? What's your underlying health situation? And then I'll tell them, no, you don't sound like you have COVID at all. You don't have to worry. And then the biggest injustice is when you have people who've already been sick with COVID a month ago or 2 months ago, legitimately sick, and then they test positive a month later or 2 months later, and they're still quarantining them. And I'm like, no, you've already gotten over this. You don't need to do this. You're going to test positive for up to 6 months after you've had COVID,
Yeah.
So
I've heard of that. I have a friend who was tested positive, and then he told the doctor, well, I've already had it and been sick. And then the doctor changed the result because he said, oh, well, those are antibodies.
Yeah. Well, there's antibody testing, which is serologic. That's done with the blood. That's the only way to get the only way to know that you have the antibodies is through a blood test. The swabs in the nose are looking just for the antigen, which, again, those are high false positives. But I do. I'll get the antibody test on folks, and just to show them. I had a lady come in. I can go on and on. I had a lady come in. She's almost 90 years old. She just wanted to know if she had a positive antibody for SARS-2, COVID antibody from Quest Lab. I said, well, looky there. You must have been exposed at some point. She never had been sick. But, she's not going to get the vaccine. That's for dang sure. That's another story. But we definitely are at a point in our society where fear is the driving force, and I believe it affected a lot of things, as we know, politically recently and may well into the future, and just driving, like we said, they started at the beginning of our conversation, people are just making irrational decisions. They're not going back to work, to school, to church. They're not going to their doctor's offices. Oh, let me tell you two quick stories about testing positive, how irrational and even inhumane this has been. I had one woman pregnant, 32 weeks, got COVID, had some difficulty breathing, had to go in the hospital, never got that sick, thank goodness. She was young and healthy otherwise, but just needed a little bit of oxygen because she's so large with her baby. When she came back, her obstetrician wouldn't see her anymore because she tested positive. That was so horrible. She had to go to a tertiary center, down the road, because her local doctor was afraid to see her because she had COVID. And I've had similar with patients who want to visit their loved ones in the hospital. They ask, have you tested positive for COVID? And even though they might have had it a month or two, have you had COVID? 2 months ago, yeah, but not now. Well, the hospital says, well, sorry, you can't come see your dad, your mom, your sister, whatever, because you've had COVID. It was like, well, this is a month ago. Well, you're not. I had another patient who was in the hospital, intubated with severe COVID pneumonia, got over it. We just wanted to get him to a rehab. Nobody would take him because he kept testing positive. And finally, the infectious disease doctors and the pulmonary and myself said, this guy's no longer contagious. He's just testing positive. He's been in the hospital over a month to 6 weeks. No one stays infectious more than the average length is no more than 10 days, which is why Even the CDC recently lowered the 14 days to 10 days, and even in some cases a week, if you look at the bell curve of infectivity, contagiousness. So we have been treating these positive tests as evidence of contagiousness, and that is wrong. They're not even evidence of illness to begin with 90% of the time. They're certainly not evidence of being contagious. The contagious period is typically 2 days before your onset of symptoms, up to 10 days total. And that's all we should be thinking about.
Yeah. And so I've, from what my reading, I've read that the PCR test should be accompanied by the number of cycles that was run. And that seems to be have been explicitly forbidden in this whole crisis. And I was wondering if you have any insights on that.
I don't have any insights into why the labs have gotten away with that kind of testing or false reporting, I guess is what I'd say. And again, Governor DeSantis kind of drew a hard line on December 3rd, I believe, in Florida. And I had it, people can look it up, cyclic threshold in Florida.
Good for him.
Good for him. Well, he's good for him in many respects. I mean, we're really doing much better here. But listen, there's so much shadiness going on. I'm part of this large group of docs that are, you know, Peter McCullough and Ray Oskry and the Dr. Raymond, who's been on television and testifying before the Senate. And we're all trying to get the truth out about, what things seem to make sense. Or if nothing else, have a dialogue. And then we're looking, like I just read one from the state of Maryland where this doctor, they're forbidden in the state of Maryland to prescribe hydroxychloroquine for early treatment. I mean, the state board of medical examiners there basically said no, it's verboten. And I'm like, why would you ever do that to doctors? Tell them that they're not allowed to try something that hydroxychloroquine, that we do know, does several things. And I'm not going to get into the science of that because I would leave that to Peter McCullough. But I know I've used it for my patients. It does help to stabilize the hemoglobin molecule. It does help to it thins the blood a bit. I mean, we've seen some of that. Ivermectin, I'm sure you're familiar, is now the new kid on the block. And we're all kind of, because there's been studies out of South America that showed how legitimate that was for preventing and for treating in the early stages COVID-19. So we have options out there because this is such a unique virus. You're not using traditional antiviral medications like people would, say Tamiflu or the things that are used for herpes viruses or other antivirals. Remdesivir is a classic antiviral agent, but this is not. And as I'm sure you might have heard, remdesivir, which is only given in the hospital setting.
Yeah.
Or for that matter, people are giving monoclonal antibodies. It's rather interesting, isn't it, that the only therapies that people are actually embracing are the ones that are given in the hospital setting that are extremely expensive.
Oh, yeah.
When we docs are out there, we're looking at things that cost $20 that we believe and we have seen are helpful. And you talk about the influence of the American Hospital Association and the pharmaceutical industry. As I said at the very beginning, this is what's happening. They are totally influencing how we doctors are able to prescribe treatments for our patients.
Because
I bring it up at a staff meeting, and I get shut down by the hospital.
Yeah, I think, things like hydrochloroquine, it's not like it's an experimental drug. It's been around for a long time and used, I think, in this case, in very small doses, right?
Like it's 200 milligrams twice a day, which is, or maybe at the most three times, is what we give an 80-year-old person who has rheumatoid arthritis. It's a very safe drug. For 60 years now, and ivermectin's been around for a couple of decades, mostly as an antiparasitic. And it's interesting the qualities. I love the fact. What I love with this group of docs, and I have about 1,000 emails, frankly, that I've accumulated. I'm going to be spending my weekend, hopefully, printing out a few of the salient articles. But these are pharmacologists. These are basic researchers. They're physicians in clinical practice. They're epidemiologists. It's a large group of doctors around the world that are now have teamed up. We're all working together to kind of bring together the clinical picture and the basic science, and having a dialogue, which you don't see happening. One of the horrible things in society right now, horrible trend, is Zoom meetings. Zoom meetings are horrendous. The hospitals will put together a meeting with the medical staff, and it's controlled by like three people.
Oh.
And if you've been on any of those meetings, people are not tuned in at 100% like you would if you had a normal medical staff meeting.
Yeah.
A medical staff meeting, you're sitting in a room and people are having a dialogue. You know, you could have 20, 30, 50 docs in a room. That's not happening anymore. People aren't having those conversations. So this email group that we have is at least for now taking the place of the normal dialogue that doctors would have. And I think it's to the detriment of patients that, doctors in communities no longer are having a dialogue about how best to prevent and treat this disease.
Yeah, only the expensive hospital interventions are allowed. Just speaks to how corrupt our whole medical system has become. And I think because they also are in large part control of the content of the mainstream media, I think they're the major advertiser in all the mainstream media, including public television and public radio. And you don't hear a debate about any of these science issues. It's really
no. It's all geared tragic. Towards you don't. If you're anti, if you come out against the vaccine, which I have, because I've said, you know, I mean, the whole politics of 2020 was based on this vaccine, and you know, you think of the billions and billions of dollars that were given to these companies to make the vaccine, then they turn around, they're going to generate extra billions and likely trillions of profit from it after being given billions to develop it. But there was never a chance that anything cheaper was going to be able to get a leg up, because it was like, no, let's not listen. And yet, every patient I've had that I've given, and the treatments are all varied, I will say. I'm not going to say there's no one-size-fits-all. Let's face it, as I said at the very beginning, a huge number of people don't need anything for COVID, right? A great quantity of people just get a simple cold. Why? The first person that got a vaccine in the state of Florida was a 31-year-old nurse. Now, I get the fact that she was a nurse, but the fact that she was 31, she should not have gotten the vaccine. I mean, she should be able to do things to take care of herself and prevent this. And yet, you know, I mean, I would have probably said, what I've said about the vaccine is maybe a captive nursing home population where nobody's going to give them anything if they get to COVID, and yeah, maybe that's a reasonable place to start. Maybe certain older healthcare workers that are in the ICU with these patients. But by and large, though, even in those settings, we, as I said, we haven't been giving people the benefit of, all right, daily vitamin D and zinc, vitamin C. All right, you know, everyone has heard about vitamin D, zinc, vitamin C, and then perhaps prophylaxing them preventive treatment with once a week or twice a week hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin. These are options that are out, that are on the table, that we're having serious conversations about, that if we were to do this as a society, we'd be much cheaper and much less risky than universal vaccination with the first ever messenger RNA vaccine. And if you look at the side effects of the mRNA vaccines, the number one thing we're seeing other than local site reactions is lymphadenopathy, meaning the lymphatic system, which is producing your antibodies, these lymph nodes, they get swell up, they enlarge, and people who are getting that, about 30% of them, and probably more if people did. That concerns me, that the immune system is reacting so aggressively to this brand new type of vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what the long-term consequences of that, of gearing up that immune system are going to be. You might have heard that in reproductive age women, you know, the concern was that it's going to produce an antibody towards one of the proteins that leads to placental development in the newborn. It could conceivably attack the actual developing placenta because the protein, it's called a spike protein that is attacking in the virus, is similar to the protein that's in the placenta. And I don't have the name, but you can look it up. It's a legitimate concern. It's out there. But do you think anybody did a study on reproductive age women and future fertility? I mean, obviously not. In 10 months, you can't do a study on that.
Yeah.
So does anybody even care about the fertility of women that's out there with these vaccines? I mean, I can guarantee you there's a lot of people in the vaccine industry who don't care about fertility being preserved. So for a variety of reasons. So I have my serious concerns about this vaccine having been rushed and implemented for political reasons.
What do you think the point is, if you could speculate a little bit, for developing a vaccine against a disease that, with my understanding, has among people with no other conditions, no other comorbidities, has a 99.73 survival rate, I think was the last time I looked. And so,
no, you're right.
So why are we vaccinating against something that, if you look at the data, is not a threat to most people?
You think about the history of vaccines, and I have a whole YouTube video on vaccines, but if you look at what we traditionally vaccinated against, they were mostly childhood illnesses, right, for a long time. We lost children, right, from the most recent one in my career was Haemophilus influenza, HIVVAX, which I did see children with encephalitis and meningitis when I was in training, and you don't see that anymore. So that was a good vaccine, the Haemophilus influenza vaccine, saved children. Then you had, of course, the whole thing with polio, which there's a lot of politics about when polio was first diagnosed, when a lot of people think it was more related to some environmental conditions. And there was a big debate about whether oral polio for so many years, in fact, we were giving people polio because it was a live viral vaccine. So there was that. And then you have now in the elderly, the big push over the last couple of decades has been flu shots and pneumonia shots in the elderly.
Yeah.
All right. You might get that, but these are still people, in my experience, who have underlying comorbidities, you know, that they're going to get pneumonia and die if they get pneumonia or the flu and die. You know, I may not need to get a flu shot or pneumonia shot. The hospital requires me to get a flu shot, but other than that, but now we have a vaccine that is universally going to be applied. They're saying they're going to start out with the quote-unquote high-risk population, and I can see a little bit of that possibly, as I said earlier, but dang it, if they're, you know, to the idea that we're going to have a vaccine for everybody on the planet, which is what people are asking for, the Bill Gates of the world and the Anthony Fauci's, is horrible. It's just horrible reasoning. You're right. I mean, there are so many ways people are dying. As I just told you, of the 20-plus patients that have died in my practice, I've had two patients commit suicide this year, okay?
Wow.
And you can be sure, you know, where that came from, right? I mean, it was just that horrible. Well, the one guy lost his job, and he was he had no meaning. He was in a bad marriage, and it was just horrible. It was a direct consequence of what was happening in response to COVID hysteria. And the other gentleman was older. His wife had died in the hospital. He couldn't see her. And it just, you know, before she died, and he just took his way. He was an older guy, took his life. I mean, but this is suicide rates across the country have at an all-time high, including in adolescents and children. More children have died from suicide during COVID than from COVID.
God,
all right, I'm
awful.
Talking up to the age of 18. So if you just look up the numbers. So I'm just saying that we as a society are obsessed with this vaccine saving lives, and we're ignoring all the bad things that have happened as a result, frankly, of the COVID hysteria. We need to get back to normal as a society. We need to get back to normal patient-physician relationships. I had another patient die from metastatic cancer, who had decided to stop going to her oncologist up in Gainesville, Florida, during the COVID peak in April. Mm-hmm. And her husband didn't know she'd stopped going until she came into my office in May, and it was clear. I said, oh, my gosh, your leukemia is back. I mean, she was white as a ghost. She was dead in 3 days, young lady, younger than me.
Wow.
And her husband, I'll never forget the look on his face when he asked her, why didn't you go to the cancer doctor? She said, I didn't want to leave the house. You know, so this is the stuff I've had to deal with for 9 months, and I'm fed up with it because we need to stop acting like COVID is the be-all and the end-all of our existence, and that the vaccine is somehow going to be a panacea for everything that's wrong in health. It's not.
Well,
it's going to create a whole new bunch of problems.
One thing that shocked me was hearing Anthony Fauci said, well, even if you get vaccinated, you'll still have to wear a mask and you'll still have to, you know, what they call social distancing. And I said, well, what is the point of the vaccine if it isn't going to solve things? So,
no, right. Yeah, this is Anthony Fauci is the. There are people who love the guy and God bless him. But I'll give you one little story about Fauci. I knew back in May. There's a great guy on the radio named Hugh Hewitt. All right, he's actually was probably the most providential. He was a prophet back in, I believe it was in March even. He was on the radio talking about this virus in China. And I happened to be listening that day, and he was talking to Senator Tom Cotton, and saying, guys, this is going to be a legitimate threat to America because it started in China. So he brought on Fauci and back in May, and he's asking Fauci, so if you're over 75, you know, and you're relatively healthy and you live down here in the villages in Florida or whatever, what's your advice? And he says, well, if you're over 75 and you're a healthy guy and you golf and you're healthy, you know, you can do so. You can go out and you can do normal things. Just don't get around large groups, but go out and lead a normal life. At the end of the same show, Hugh Hewitt asks Fauci, okay, Dr. Fauci, one last time, if you're 75 or older, what's your advice? Oh, he says, stay at home. Don't go out. Just stay at home. In the same interview.
Yeah, it's
the
bizarre.
Man turned to the did a 180 on if you're 75 or older. He's done the same thing with masks. He's doing the same thing. I mean, I don't know what the problem is with him, but he's really not someone to rely on for information. It seems to me whoever's whispering in his ear, whichever pharmaceutical or vaccine industry, you know, one minute or is really influencing the way he's thinking. And that's how I feel he's always operated, to be honest with you. But that's just my gut, and I may be way off base. But I can tell you one thing. I take care of patients day in, day out. For a lot of years now, and I see the way this COVID hysteria has affected children and elderly people who have not been able to see their loved ones before they've died, and vice versa. It's just been a horrendous time for society. It's been a horrendous illness, to be sure, but I believe the solution, if I had to sum it up, is to start. You know, obviously everyone needs to pray. I'm a big fan of prayer. Mm-hmm. But I think let doctors be doctors, respect science, respect evidence, realize that most of what you're hearing on the television is not based on pure science. It's not based on evidence-based medicine. It's not based on peers talking to peers, doctors talking to doctors. It's a top-down agenda from the American Hospital Association, the pharmaceutical, the vaccine industry, and government agencies, which, by the way, it's not Trump's CDC or Trump's FDA. These are agencies that have had an agenda that I've written about in a book called The Hidden Truth on deception in healthcare. It's out there as well if you look under Dr. Littell, John Littell. So I'm very familiar with deception in medicine going back 25 years now, at least, that I've been doing research. What I see when I go to talks, lectures, congresses of doctors, and I hear people giving talks that are blatantly biased, blatantly deceptive, and when I call them out on it, you could hear a pin drop. So I've been doing this kind of stuff for a long time, John, and so there's nothing new about how healthcare is going. It's just that COVID basically makes it front and center in everyone's life now. It used to be that just the doctors were the victims and then patients may or may not be victims as well.
Yeah.
But now the whole society has fallen victim to this agenda that I won't get into what the ultimate agenda is because that's a very big issue for another day. But suffice it to say, the main goal is to take the control of healthcare away from the doctor, mm-hmm. away from the patient in the context of the medical office. And put it elsewhere. It's given, and there is a. I will say this: there was a book written years ago called "Rules for Radicals" by Saul Alinsky. And I know I'm not throwing this out there because you may have people who are Republican, Democrat, whatever, anything in between.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying what he wrote as in terms of how to get control over people. The first rule was control healthcare, and you control people, and. That is what I'm seeing in my lifetime as a physician. Increasingly, other people are controlling healthcare so that they can control the minds of people and their behavior. And I, as a doctor, find that very frustrating when I have to, you know, patients are learning how to be, they're learning everything about their diseases from television.
Sure.
And they come in to see me, and I just have to validate what they think is wrong, as opposed to coming to me as a doctor and us working it out. As a team,
yeah.
You know, so we really have a problem in medicine right now, where more and more doctors are just following protocols and algorithms rather than using their education and training and their independent reasoning ability.
Yeah, well, that's excellent. My understanding was being a doctor and being a healer was an art, not just looking at test results, which, you know, have various meanings.
Yeah. And people are obsessed with test results. People are obsessed with testing and test results. And I tell my patients, I say, please don't, if do you think I'm going to be a doctor who does all those, gets an MRI for everything or tests for everything? I said, there's a consequence to every test. And as we're hearing now, we're seeing now, there's a consequence to unnecessary testing for COVID. And it's not a good consequence at all. There's no benefit to it, to society or to the human being, if you're getting tested when you have no, like I said, what's the benefit of getting tested? What are you going to do differently if you're a high school kid and you test positive? You're a 30-year-old, you're 50. We're not, do the right things to keep your immune system healthy. Use your smarts, and if you're getting sicker, there are things we can do with early treatment. But no, I appreciate that you are right on with that. It is an art. It's an art that is. I have medical students with me all the time anymore. They're always looking for solo. They really have a hard time finding family doctors that they can rotate with anymore because so many of the doctors have sold out their practices to these mega outfits. So I'm one of the few independent docs left in our town, where medical students can actually come in and see what it's like to have a real, legitimate, old-fashioned family practice where you run the show. And they love it. They love it. And I see them, a lot of them, I see a spark in there. They like the fact that we have that meaningful relationship with our patients. That whereas there's other doctor's offices in our towns, and I'm sure your listeners know, I've heard people go into offices during COVID where they have to keep their distance. The doctor won't listen to them. I dermatologist who won't even touch the patient. stand over there and take off your shirt. I'm going to look, anyway.
With binoculars.
With whatever they've got. Yeah. Binoculars. Yeah. This is just my own experience in Florida, what I've heard. I can go on and on about what it must be in the rest of the country with the medical profession. So I refuse to cave under pressure and hysteria to that kind of behavior. We're not meant to be that as doctors for our patients. So I appreciate you giving me the time to ventilate to your audience and to you today on this stuff. It's clearly near and dear to my heart. So.
Yeah, well, I can see that, and I wish you were up here, and we could all visit your office, because our office has been consolidated or swallowed up by the hospital system here in my little town. So I'm afraid you're describing exactly what goes on everywhere.
Yes. Yeah, it is. It doesn't mean there's not hope. It's a season for hope, and I have to be. If I wasn't an optimist, how could I go on? I mean, we have to be optimistic for the future. And shows like yours, and just if the little bit of truth, if everybody who's listening can go to my book on deception and healthcare, The Hidden Truth, and you'll learn a lot in there, or go to my YouTube videos and. They won't be up for much longer, probably. They took one down already.
Yeah.
But and just share what you can. I mean, I don't do any of this, obviously, for anything other than to get the truth, what I believe is the truth. And as I say in one of my videos and in my book, I wasn't a doctor you necessarily could have trusted 25 years ago, because I was still very much under the influence of the medical school and the residency training that I had. I actually had to unlearn a lot of things, relearn things without the bias of the pharmaceutical industry and other agendas that we get in training. So that's why that last video on who to trust and what to believe, I think you'll find interesting. So,
okay.
But that's I'm going to have to run. God bless you, and thank you for the opportunity, John.
Yeah. Dr. John Littell, thanks so much for being on the radio show Politics and Science, and I hope to talk to you again soon.
We'll be here for you. Have a blessed holiday season.
Bye-bye. Yeah, thanks. Yeah. Merry Christmas to you, too.
Merry Christmas.
Okay.
Bye-bye now.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the birds in the trees. Cause they know we were born to be free. Don't need the government cramping my style. Give them an inch, they take a mile. Take you in with a phony smile. Wouldn't you agree? The new normal is not normal. It's no kind of normal at all. Everyone seemed to have amnesia, just trying to remember the Berlin Wall. the benefit of you and me. No, no, no. Normal is not normal. It's no kind of normal at all. Everyone seemed to have amnesia, trying to remember. But the Berlin Wall is some kind of new old ideology, running tandem with a weird kind of psychology. But it's not for the benefit of you and me, 'cause we were born to be free, 'cause we were born to be free, 'cause we were born to be free.